Hi, and welcome to the Provider Podcast. I'm Adam Brimlow, and this week we're discussing one of the absolute key priorities for the NHS, workforce wellbeing. Health service staff are under pressure as never before, with high vacancies, staff sickness, poor morale, concerns over burnout, and of course, the damaging impact of industrial action. Yet we know a happy and healthy workforce results in better patient outcomes and reduced healthcare costs, and makes the NHS a more attractive employer, better place to recruit and retain staff. So it's great to have examples of how trusts are making workforce wellbeing a priority with significant success. And that's what we're talking about in this podcast, with a very close eye on NHS providers' report, Providers Deliver, Enabling Wellbeing Within Trusts. We have six case studies setting out a range of approaches in different settings and situations, and to guide us through them, I've been talking to NHS Providers Policy Advisor for Workforce, Zosia Walenska. I began by asking her why workforce wellbeing is so important.
Staff are the backbone of the NHS. The ability for the NHS to deliver high quality patient care is dependent on a workforce that is happy and healthy. So the wellbeing of staff is not just a moral imperative, it directly impacts the effectiveness and sustainability of the healthcare system. And it's more important than ever. 2022 saw the highest rate of turnover of staff on record, and the recent NHS staff survey saw really worrying metrics on staff wellbeing. So almost a third of staff feel burnt out, almost half feel worn out at the end of their shift, and a third of staff are thinking of leaving their organisation, which is a five-year high. So the NHS can't function without its workforce. It can't function without a happy and healthy workforce. And the data is telling us there's a really urgent need to support their wellbeing to ensure a functioning NHS.
So what you're describing there is a real impact on the morale and on retention of NHS staff in recent years.
Yeah, so NHS staff have been working through sustained, intense operational pressures over recent years. And over the last decade, these pressures have been intensified by high staff vacancies, cuts to funding, increase in patient demand, and increase in patient acuity. And a number of external factors, such as the COVID-19 pandemic, the cost of living crisis, and now the longest period of industrial action, are further exacerbating these pressures. And staff are working through an elective backlog of 7.8 million. And it's really taking the toll on them. So a recent GMC survey found that only 25% of doctors feel able to cope with their workload. And the vacancy rate is now at 125,000, which is an 11% increase on the quarter before. So morale and retention is really worrying at the moment. And as well as intense operational pressures, we know that pay is a key lever to retention, and only 26% of staff feel satisfied with their level of pay. And alongside this, staff are working in environments that are not fit for purpose, and they don't have access to adequate rest space. And this is having a real impact on morale and retention. So a BMA survey found that 38% of doctors said that the lack of available rest space was having a negative or significantly negative impact on their well-being at work. And finally, the workplace experience of staff is really impacting morale. So the relative likelihood of disabled staff entering a formal capability process compared to non-disabled staff has worsened year on year. And ethnic minority staff are still less likely to report their organisation acts fairly on career progression and promotions compared to their white peers. So that's having a real impact on morale and retention. And taken together, it's really worrying, all these factors.
Certainly a very long list of concerns there. And we'll be hearing in a moment about some of the things that trust leaders have been doing to try to address them. But there's obviously a role here for the government and for NHS England as well. What support have we seen nationally?
NHS England's health and wellbeing framework has been a really useful tool for trusts to effectively integrate health and wellbeing support into their organisation and allow them to tailor interventions to their workforce, because all organisations are at different points in the support they're offering and they all have different needs. Alongside that, NHS England's Retention Hub has also been a really effective tool for peer learning for trusts to embed comprehensive support and learn from trusts what is working. The opening of staff mental health and wellbeing hubs during COVID was a really practical response to clear need, and they made really big improvements on staff wellbeing and staff's ability to stay in work. However, the funding for those has been withdrawn, which is really disappointing because it's clear the level of need has not gone away. Alongside all of this, the NHS People Plan, Long-Term Workforce Plan, and EDI Improvement Plan are all really welcome policies that support NHS organisations to create environments and working practices that are supportive for their staff. So there's much to welcome nationally, and there's much to welcome from these policies, and they're really important for enabling local level drivers, such as organisational culture. However, there is a lot of drivers in national control, such as pay and working conditions, that must be enabled to sustainably resolve the high vacancy rates that we're seeing and the high levels of workload demand.
And Zosia, we're going to be focusing on effective interventions by trust through a series of case studies set out in our Providers Deliver report. But before we go into detail on those, I know there are some broad themes that you've picked out that underpin a successful approach to staff wellbeing.
So one really key enabler to successfully embedding support for staff wellbeing is when organisations have a serious focus on implementing compassionate and inclusive cultures and a sense of belonging for all staff. So trust leaders know that when staff feel valued and respected and listened to, staff are more likely to feel satisfied in their jobs and committed to their organisation. And so when organisations are accepting and have zero tolerance to exclusion and unfair treatment, there are demonstrable improvements in staff wellbeing and retention of their staff. Another really key enabler is investment in physical working environments and investment in mental health support. So rest spaces and getting the basics right for physical environments are often overlooked. But it's really important that staff work in environments that are fit for purpose and are well maintained because it boosts productivity, motivation, and overall boosts well-being. But funding for that is essential. And then on a similar note, funding for mental health support is essential for staff to be able to stay in work. So stress, anxiety, and depression are the most common reasons for staff sickness absence. And we know that healthcare professionals often work long hours. They're physically exhausted, they have high stress levels, and they're leaving the service because of those reasons. So, investing in the mental wellbeing support for staff is really vital for them to be able to remain in work and really vital to support their wellbeing. And funding is essential for that. And lastly, a final key enabler to ensuring that staff wellbeing is supported is collecting data. Ensuring that interventions are effective and not just a tick box exercise to ensure that the intended positive impact is being made on staff wellbeing. And when you collect data, you can adjust interventions, you can stop them, you can carry them on, or change them as needed based on the data that's being collected. And ensuring that you have informed investment and informed interventions based on need is really important to successfully improving staff wellbeing.
Okay, well, let's turn to our case studies and start with getting the strategic approach right, as we've seen in Mersey and West Lancashire Teaching Hospitals NHS Trust. Zosia, their starting point was a robust health and wellbeing strategy.
So Mersey and West Lancashire have published their health and wellbeing operational plans. So this encompasses their whole approach to creating and sustaining a culture of wellbeing within the trust. And it's a really strategic approach to what is needed within the trust. And to go alongside that, they produce a biannual report which gathers insight and empirical assessments of the impact of their plan to ensure that it is making the intended need to support the wellbeing of their staff.
And I've been talking to Adam Hodkinson, who's their Assistant Director of Health, Work and Wellbeing.
So back in 2020, we secured investment into our service to review the team and our service delivery model. So this gave us an opportunity to enhance and introduce new models of practice, really. And that new model of practice was a wellbeing team, and to reshape other areas such as occupational health and the business functions to improve outputs and outcomes. So there was a plan previously, but this was purely focused really around the NHS People Plan and how the Trust realised those objectives from the plan and what we needed to do in practice. So the new health, work and wellbeing operational plan needed to consider these historical requirements, but also some new agendas and topics, and have a refocus really around what does wellbeing mean from an organisational perspective and a workforce perspective. So the new plan considers things like having a holistic approach to wellbeing, and we consider the holistic approach in sort of seven areas. So spiritual, social, emotional, psychological, physical, environmental and financial health or wellbeing. And they're really important points to take forward in our planning. And whenever we do something around, well, actually, is this particular program of activity or initiative focused around financial wellbeing, for example? But there's other things that we wanted to consider. So more emphasis on equality, diversity and inclusion, health inequalities as well. The plan was really doing a bit of a deep dive into the demography, the makeup of our organization, and then a reconsideration of, well, what does health and wellbeing mean positively for our workforce going forwards. The new plan also looked at things like more collaborative and partnership working, so linking in with other plans as well. So it was an opportunity for the organisation to have a refresh and a rethink about organisational development plans and a revision of new policies, so the introduction of menopause policy, reasonable adjustments policy, absence management, etc. So it's really an opportunity to reset and rethink about how the health and wellbeing operational plan can be cohesive with all of those new models of practice, if you like. The wellbeing dashboard is something that it is a benefit realization tool, really, and it's a tool that we put together as part of that operational plan to be able to showcase, well, what does good look like? How are we performing? And it's championed by a non-executive director. So it's a biannual report. And it's about, again, coming back to that wellbeing network, our wellbeing guardian, who's one of our non-executive directors, you know, we have that information being presented and engaged from an executive and board level right the way through to people on the ground. So it gives that an outlook, really, to what are we actually achieving in any period of time. So it's a kind of strategic overview, and it's looking at what is the impact through health and wellbeing on the organization at large.
You've been able to inform yourselves through the gathering of data insights on staff health and wellbeing. Have there been any surprise findings that have emerged from this activity?
Not surprise. I think what we've been able to do, I think what the wellbeing dashboard does is, as I say, make best use of all of that information available to us. So the data that we look at is absence performance data, demography data, occupational health data. So we're looking at, well, what does that information tell us as well? And triangulating the information to tell a story ultimately. But what it also enables us to do through the insights is track any progress, monitor our performance. And we've got into quite a positive cycle now of, where at all possible, we showcase best practice. So we can feed back to ourselves and do that reflective piece around saying, well, actually, we've tried something. We've done a targeted initiative here. And it has worked really well. And one other thing to finish on there. So we benchmark ourselves also regionally and nationally where at all possible, just to have a gauge of how we're performing, because we know we're performing well internally, but what does that mean through a wider outlook? And the People Promise theme, so the NHS England obviously do the staff survey every year. We have a successful campaign in the staff survey each year, but they've introduced the People Promise themes. And one of the themes in there is we are safe and healthy. And that's a combination of multiple question sets themed around wellbeing, agenda and the impact that that's having on staff. And we were the best in the Northwest and in Cheshire and Merseyside for positive response in We Are Safe and Healthy. So again, we're using this insight to measure the impact that we're having on the organisation. And that response is coming from individuals throughout the workforce. So it's looking at things in a different way as well. So obviously sickness absence data, I suppose, for an example, is reactive. It's kind of happened. That's an event that's occurred where, say, measuring things like the People Promise scores, that's more of a mindset, a preventative way of looking at things, because that's what people are telling you ahead of time. So we're able to look at multiple layers through different lenses to measure the performance. And that's ultimately what, I suppose, the wellbeing dashboard is trying to achieve.
Do you have plans to sort of build on it, develop on it? What happens next?
Yeah, I think we're going to continue to monitor and review our performance and that benefit realization. But I think that we have to constantly evolve and adapt as to what that actually means. And I think because our model now And our strategy, if you like, is to be targeted and tailored. We're just going to do more of that, really. So continue to showcase best practice, learn from programs of activities and events, and continue to collaborate and enhance our wellbeing network and enhance data and systems in a more automated way. So I think our wellbeing dashboard, it is quite mandrolic. So we want to see where we can automate that in the future, but also sharing that best practice and sort of showcasing what we've gained from having something like a wellbeing dashboard in place at quite a strategic level.
Adam Hodkinson there. So I'm still with Zosia Walenska. Zosia, could you tell me about some of the other case studies that have been featured in this Providers Deliver report?
Yes, so I spoke to Lincolnshire Partnership NHS Foundation Trust about the support that they have in place for their workforce through their in-house staff wellbeing service, which has been up and running for almost 13 years now. So this is a dedicated staff wellbeing service that has a team of a variety of mental health practitioners, and staff have access to psychological therapy. They have access to various workshops, bespoke workshops, and support for remaining and returning to work. The impact that they have seen on staff is undeniable. 99% of staff who have accessed the staff wellbeing service have said it had a positive impact on their wellbeing, it's helped them to do their job better, and it's supported them to stay in work or get back to work more quickly. Cornwall Partnership spoke to me about the investments that they have made in supporting their increasingly diverse workforce and the comprehensive support they have for their internationally educated nurses through high quality pastoral care. This support and investment that they've made in creating a culturally compassionate environment has allowed staff to thrive, and it's supported staff through difficult challenges of adjustment.
And I think, Zosia, there was a further interesting case study from East of England Ambulance Service.
Yeah, about the work that they've been doing to support concerns about staff being able to speak up and feel safe at work and supported to speak up. So, a healthy speak up culture and feeling psychologically safe at work is really important to staff wellbeing. And East of England recognised that they had quite serious implications of their trust culture for that. So, they've worked to repair trust and confidence among staff to ensure that staff feel listened to and responded to, and they've seen really great improvements in their wellbeing. Finally, Royal Berkshire spoke to me about the dedicated health and wellbeing centre that they have at the trust called The Oasis, which is open for all staff, and it has a number of facilities, including exercise rooms, TV rooms, a lounge room, a fully equipped kitchen. And it's a facility that is quiet, it's non-clinical, and it's designed to support all aspects of staff well-being. And it's a really clear demonstration that the trust values their staff and wants them to be able to work to the best of their ability. And the improvements that they've seen on staff well-being are really clear.
And there's one further case study, isn't there, Zosia? A really interesting one looking at the importance of supportive and inclusive cultures.
Yes, so Oxley's have three core aims within the trust, and one of them is making the trust a great place to work. So, Oxley's have implemented a range of inclusivity tools to ensure staff feel safe and valued, and they put in a broad range of support so that staff feel that they are able to be their authentic self at work and really thrive in the workplace, which is really key to one's well-being and motivation at work.
Great. So let's hear from Juliana Frederick James, who's Head of Equality and Human Rights at Oxley's.
So the Building a Fairer Oxley's program started a couple of years ago in the middle of COVID, when it became really clear that there was health inequality that was being experienced by service users, but also by staff. And we had an opportunity to have some frank and honest conversations with staff about their experience of working in the organization. And we came up with the Building a Fairer Oxley's as a way of improving the experience of working in Oxley's and helping the organisation to be more inclusive, because it's always been diverse, the NHS. It's been diverse from the day that it opened, but it's how do we recognise and value that difference? So the five-step challenge now is the mechanism that we're trying to use to help all the teams in the organisation embrace this new way of dealing with things. So the first step is you'd have a conversation about a difference in your team. Now, the difference doesn't have to be about race or disability. It can be any difference. So it's nice to give people the space to talk about what that difference is, what it feels like, and what more we can do to help people feel that we include them and that we love them in exactly the same way. The second part of the steps would be to make sure that even though you've had the conversation once, that you will continue to have that conversation as part of your team meeting so that it's not a one-off. It continues to be something that influences what you do and also helps us shape how we respond to service users as well. So it's kind of really an interesting way of doing it. Everyone can create a BAFO charter. And the whole point of the Building a Fairer Oxley is it's about making a positive difference every day. That's the challenge to us all as staff. And what we want for everyone to do in the charter is talk about how we stand up for fairness, how we're here to listen and learn, how we acknowledge that there are problems, and how we welcome challenges. So we've done that, which is really good. Step four is a personal commitment. Every single member of the team has to make a decision how they want to take that forward, whatever that issue is, whether it is that they'll do some more training or some more raising awareness sessions to try and get a sense of what it is that's going on, or even some people will take it into their personal development plan and decide that there are actions that they want to take personally that they can actually see that they're going to make a difference. And then finally, the fifth step is to actually share what it is that you've done with the rest of the organization. So we like to have these celebrations perhaps once a quarter where everyone comes together and talks about the things that they have done and people can share what it is. But it's literally how you get that message out to the teams so that everyone feels that they're part of this. And it's still a work in progress.
Yeah, and you've backed that up with a very conscious and deliberate approach to reasonable adjustments as well, haven't you? What have you done there? What sort of areas have you concentrated on?
So first of all, we have a wellness action plan, which has to be completed by, it's like a well-being passport that every staff member should have, a well-being passport that explains what the situation might be, what conditions they may have, what adjustments might be needed to make sure that they can deliver the best that they can deliver. But I think one of the most important things we decided to do was to have a centralized reasonable adjustment budget. And the reason for that is that sometimes staff need an adjustment and the directorate will rightfully turn around and say, we haven't got any money. No one has any money. They never have any money. But we do have a duty of care. So we do need to do this. So we thought if we at least have a centralized budget, it gives people an opportunity to not use the excuse that they haven't got the budget, but actually to just get the stuff that people need so that they can do the best that they can do. So that's what we've decided to do. And I think the benefits of having a centralized budget is that you know that you can get things done quickly as opposed to waiting for too long.
Let's just develop that point about the benefits that you're seeing from the approach you're taking in terms of how that's being fed back by staff and the tangible impacts that you're seeing.
Okay, so earlier in the year, there was a survey that was being done for the Sunday Times. And I was thinking, no one's going to fill in that form. I don't know why we're going in for these things. I don't know what we're doing. But actually, a lot of staff did. And we came out as an organization that actually people who are working for us feel that we are doing the best that we can for people with disabilities. I think what's really interesting is people are having the conversations. You can hear the conversations. People contact us and my team and say to us, can you come along and talk to us about some of these things? And because we're having the conversations, I think it's making that difference. But, you know, it isn't just about the money. It's about the environment that this is somewhere that you can thrive and be the best that you can be. And I think that is what we're kind of working towards. And I'm getting murmurings that we might be heading in the right direction, which is always really good.
Yeah, well, sounds like some pretty strong murmurings you're heading in the right direction. And presumably you're looking to really embed and build on the progress that you're already starting to see.
Yeah. I mean, I think what I will say to you is that we're still a long way from being where we want to be. So I think what we want to build on, what our next steps are going to be, is trying to encourage people to understand, one, why it's important to share that information, and two, how that helps us provide things in a much better way. What I would like to say is that I think our trust is a real example of how compassionate leadership can work. Because I think this is being driven by our board. Our board are 100% behind this. And, you know, they are our biggest champions. And so I think if you've got a board that gets it and then knows that how this is going to really positively impact on our overall aim as an organisation, then I think you're going to do well.
Juliana Frederick-James there, bringing to an end this provider podcast on workforce wellbeing. And you can find out more about all the case studies on the NHS Providers website. Just go to Providers Deliver, Enabling Wellbeing Within Trusts. And there'll be a chance to meet and talk to a lot of the people involved in these initiatives at the Providers Deliver stand at NHS Providers Annual Conference and Exhibition in Liverpool. That's the 14th and 15th of November. We'll be there recording the next edition of the Provider Podcast. So we'll be back soon. A reminder, you can join in the conversation by following us on X, formerly known as Twitter, and LinkedIn at NHS Providers with the hashtag The Provider Podcast. And keep up to date on future episodes by subscribing to the podcast. Thank you.